Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Artist, naturalist, author, blogger, NPR commentator, Julie Zicafus says it's been a busy spring, but Julie is busy by definition anyway. So what's busy to her? She has joined us today to help us catch up on her life and share her insights into nature, which often lead to insights into ourselves. Welcome back, Julie.
Well, hello, Anne. That's a wonderful introduction.
Oh, it's been a while.
It has been a while.
You've been busy, though, so I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, I really, you know, defining busy, you know, it's like the stuff I do when I say I'm busy is not normal stuff.
Checking the bluebird boxes.
Well, like, you know, right just a couple minutes ago, I was hunkered down in the driveway counting blowflies that came out of a bluebird nest. I'm really busy, so it's important stuff.
But, you know, you mentioned earlier when we were talking off the air about the abundance of this season, the abundance of rain, the abundance of heat, the abundance of whatever else comes from those, the combination of those two.
It just seems like, you know, it just seems like this year, this huge green wall of vegetation that is just threatening to take over my whole farm here. And you know, I'm just beating it back and beating it back. But by the same token, I don't have to water. It's just so awesome to have a wet spring and just to see your lettuce just grow like it looks just like it came out of the Martha Stewart catalog. You know, it's just beautiful, beautiful spring.
Well, I could kick myself because I didn't get any in this year.
Yeah,
I could just kick myself.
I had to plant it twice because my first batch drowned, just didn't even come up. And then I ran and got some really nice mesclun and some buttercrunch, which actually turned out to be buttercrunch. For a long time, I had a run on buttercrunch seeds that were actually romaine. I don't know what's going on. And then this year, I planted beautiful, beautiful sugar snap peas, which is, in my opinion, the finest vegetable on the planet. And they're all snow peas. I could kill those people at the hardware store. So I've got these gorgeous, you know, 5-foot-tall plants blooming, producing like crazy, and they're kind of like stringy and tasteless.
Yeah,
awesome.
Not your cup
Thank
of tea.
Thank you for taking up my garden.
So do you just buy the seeds by the scoop or something?
Yeah, I buy them by the scoop because I have a big garden. So, you know, I go and I trust the girl who scribbles sugar snap pea in magic marker on the brown paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
To know what she's telling me, because she's wasted my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't replant now because it's going to, of course, go to 105 degrees next week probably. So, you know, peas don't like that.
Is the weather down there a lot like it is in Columbus?
Right now it's just gray and cool and so beautiful. Oh,
it's spring now.
It feels wonderful. It's just fabulous. You know, I can do without the super humid heat and all that stuff. But, yeah, today is great. I went running, and I was like, oh, I think I could run to Kansas today.
Well, we haven't been to Kansas, but you've been to North Dakota lately.
Yeah, well, I actually felt it's interesting that Kansas came up in my subconscious because we had a 2 a.m. tornado scare in North Dakota that was just, it was like the most spectacular prairie wall cloud I have ever seen in my life. And I saw it at 2 a.m. because there was so much lightning, it was like somebody had the lights on.
Wow.
So I could see every detail of this cloud as it rumbled over our house with, like, these big sort of mammary projections dangling from it. And, you know, I just had this moment where, not moment, but I had several minutes where I was absolutely rooted in fascination, looking at this cloud and saying, I was just like those people in the YouTube videos who are filming a tornado as it goes over them and saying, oh, look at that. You can see right up into it. And I was doing the same thing. And, you know, when I'm watching those videos, I'm screaming, you fool, get to the face. What is wrong with you? Well, I did exactly the same thing. My whole family was asleep. I was the only one awake. They were all sleeping through this incredible show. And I didn't do any. I just stood there and watched it. And finally, the tornado siren went off in the next town, and I heard it over the thunder. And I grabbed everybody and pulled us all down to the basement. But it was like the science chimp meets the mother, and the science chimp won. The science chimp said, oh, this is so awesome. It was ridiculous.
My guest is Julie Zicafus. She's an NPR commentator. She's been on the show many times. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, you know, you can go on the Facebook page as well, the All Sides with Dan Fisher Facebook page. The weather has been so amazingly strange, and, you know, what they've been dealing with in
Joplin.
Well, Joplin, Missouri, and in Tennessee.
Springfield, Mass.
It just really messes with humans. What do we know about what it does to wildlife?
Oh, my gosh. I'll tell you what. I have a fellow blogger named Sharon Steitler. She calls herself Bird Chick, and she did a blog post that was absolutely devastating about, and I know this is trivial in light of the human loss, but the Minneapolis tornado that went through Minneapolis, I actually saw the path of the tornado from the plane as we flew into Minneapolis-St. Paul. And I've never actually seen tornado devastation. But as it happened, I was on the correct side of the plane, and I was looking for it, you know? Serendipity favors the prepared mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking out the window, and I see this. It looks like somebody has taken an enormous Hoover vacuum and just vacuumed a straight line of Minneapolis right through.
Minneapolis?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a tornado in Minneapolis that got very little press because Joplin got all the press.
Okay.
But anyway, to get back to my friend Sharon, she did this post about this heron rookery, like several, 20 or 30 pairs or maybe more than that of great blue herons that were nesting in a downtown park. And the tornado went right through their rookery. And you think, oh, wow, you know, birds must know. I can't imagine a bird getting killed in a tornado. Well, they did. And they were there the next day, like, digging out injured herons from underneath all this rubble with broken wings. And it went through, you know, and destroyed all the nests. And the most poignant shot she had was of about 30 great blue herons circling endlessly over what was once their rookery. And it just, you know, I thought, you know, I've never really thought about animals and birds in a tornado. I just think about people and houses and all that. But it kills everything, you know. It's the most mindless, destructive force that we can even imagine.
Sometimes when I was reading a story about New Orleans one time and someone was trying to describe the difference, and it in the process of them describing it, it all of a sudden occurred to them, one of the things that was missing was all the wildlife that you take for granted until it's wiped away.
Right. And I'll never forget the summer after Katrina went through, we went from 150 hummingbirds to one.
Hmm.
And because that hurricane hit just exactly as the birds were migrating through Louisiana. And apparently our Ohio population must go right through coastal Louisiana because they just simply weren't there. And they've, you know, they're still building back up, but I'm telling you, it's hurricanes are, these natural disasters are cruel to everyone and everything. Anyway, let's be happier.
Yeah, sorry.
How did they do that?
I don't know what got into me.
I don't either.
So North Dakota.
North Dakota. This is our ninth spring going out to North Dakota for a week in June, and that is a heck of a place to be in June. 2 years ago, we had horizontal blowing snow. First week of June.
Really?
I'm showing people prairie birds in the snow. It was awesome. And then this spring, as we were packing, I said, Bill, I really don't want to do the super jumbo sized duffel of down parkas, winter boots, coats, hats, gloves, and scarves. I just don't want to do it this year. So you know what? I'm not going to do it. And if it snows, I'm going to borrow clothes.
I thought you said you'd buy what you need there.
Yeah, well, no, we've done that too. Believe me, I have so many ugly jackets from like the local. I got to Oklahoma two springs ago, and it was like 25, and it was May, and it was like 25 degrees. So I went to Walmart and I bought these really ugly, like fleece pullovers, rubber boots. But anyway, we didn't pack for it this year, and it was gorgeous. It was like t-shirt weather out there. So you never know. But we go out to the prairie pothole region of North Dakota, which is where the ducks all breed. So you can have six species of ducks on one little tiny pond, and, you know, all of them followed by peeping ducklings. So as you can imagine, it's complete heaven for me.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. And things like marbled godwits and upland sandpipers flying over, and American avocets followed by downy chicks. It's killer. So we go out there to this Potholes and Prairies Birding Festival that is run by some dear friends of ours, just basically a tiny handful of people who get how cool the prairie is and are inviting people from all over the country to come. And this year we probably had, 30 or 40 people at the festival. So it's a very small festival. Should be bigger because the amazing birds that you can see are just incredible. And Bill and I have been going long enough that we can, you know, we can really find stuff for people. We know where to go for the sprigs, pipit, and the Baird sparrow, which are the, you know, couple of the really sexy birds that avid birders go to see, you know, that nobody else would care about.
Uh-huh.
those are the sexy birds. That's the tiny little brown things.
Were you in a prairie state last year?
We go to North Dakota every spring, and then Oklahoma 2 years ago. That was a prairie experience. I was chasing prairie chickens there for a festival.
That's right.
Yeah, lesser prairie chicken.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of these cool little local eco festivals that have sprung up all over the country. You know, sometimes celebrating a single species of bird that happens to be very endangered, perhaps, or that everybody wants to see but has never seen, like the lesser prairie chicken. So Woodworth, Oklahoma, throws this tiny little festival to get people out to see these prairie chickens doing their, you know, spring booming dance. It's pretty incredible.
Did you, you know, the biggest week of birding, do you go to that festival up by Black...
It's Black Swamp Bird Observatory.
Thank you.
Yeah, I actually can't because I'm in the middle of all my spring travel, and it coincides with the West Virginia Festival in Fayetteville that Bill and I have been doing also for 9 years. So that's at an unfortunate time for us to be able to participate. But that gets a whole lot of press up in Lake Country, Ohio.
By the way, this cryptic reference to Bill, it's Julie's husband.
Yes. Bill Thompson III.
Mm-hmm. He's an editor and publisher of the
Birdwatcher's Digest. Yeah.
That's right. You know, I'm still kind of messed up from the April Fool's joke that somebody posted about changing the name of it.
Oh.
You know, it's like it did a number on my head. Tell Bill for me. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zickafoos, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I still have my copy of Letters from Eden, your book.
Mm-hmm.
And coming up later, I want to continue to bug you about your new book. I want to talk about that more. But when you look back at Letters from Eden, do you look back through it every so often? Or
sure, yeah, mostly because I want to see if I'm repeating myself because I've entered this certain age where, like, I'm not sure if I've told this story 100 times before. So I have to be really careful.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I'll be writing, I'll say, oh my gosh, this is a great story. I can't believe I haven't told this. And then I'll like open up my book and there it is, like chapter 4. Don't tell that starling story again, Julie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm always looking for new stories and, you know, getting out is the way to do that. But yeah, I do look back through it quite a bit, especially in the writing of this next book, just to make sure that I wasn't repeating myself.
We're going to talk to Julie Zickafoos about some more of her stories coming up. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In the weather forecast for Central Ohio, mostly cloudy today, but clouds will break up and we'll have a high in the mid-70s, mostly clear tonight and overnight low in the middle 50s. North winds, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Then on Tuesday, partly cloudy. Tomorrow's high in the middle 70s. Overnight low in the mid-50s for Tuesday night, getting into Wednesday, and then on to Thursday. Partly cloudy skies, a chance of showers, maybe even a thunderstorm both days. High in the upper 70s on Wednesday, and they predict a high in the lower 80s by Thursday. Of course, your best weather forecast is to look out the window. On Point, hosted by award-winning journalist Tom Ashbrook, is here Monday through Friday at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. Lively conversation that covers everything from breaking news to ancient poetry, features writers, politicians, journalists, artists, scientists, and ordinary citizens from around the world. Listen to On Point each weekday afternoon at 1 here on 89.7 NPR News. And a reminder about ArtZine. It's WOSU's arts and culture news magazine featuring highlights of some of the best artists and groups in Central Ohio. Visit wosu.org/artzine. You can watch videos there, stories about everything from CATCO to the Wexner Center to the Columbus Museum of Art. That's Columbus at wosu.org/artzine.
Welcome back. My guest is Julie Zicafous, natural history writer, artist, and NPR commentator. Julie, let's talk about your new book. It's you've got all the drawings or all the paintings in.
Yeah. I've even written the acknowledgement, which is when you know you're really done. That's probably the hardest thing to write of all, because it's like, you know, it's like those people who get up at the award ceremony and they try to name everybody who's helped, and they wind up just going on and on. So the challenge is to make it readable, but also not leave anybody out. It's really hard to know where to stop.
How many paintings?
320 drawings and paintings, and about 80,000 words.
Wow! Is this going to be? Is that bigger than Letters from Eden?
Twice the size of Letters from Eden.
Mm-hmm. And what's the theme?
It's a memoir about my life spent with birds, and each chapter deals with a different species. So when I was thinking about the concept for the book, I sat down and I just off the top of my head, I just jotted down the birds that are the most important to me: Carolina Wren, Eastern Phoebe, Eastern Bluebird. That was easy. Mm-hmm. But then I got into, you know, some kind of interesting ones like ruffed grouse and osprey and Northern Cardinal was a challenge to write. Mourning Dove. Most of these are going to be backyard birds, which I think will probably help it appeal to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them are you know, a little bit more out there, because I may have had some cool life experience, like with piping plovers and least terns, managing their nesting colonies for 3 years in Connecticut. So I have some, you know, the book ranges around a bit. It's not just the backyard. It's just any bird that I have had really, really good interactions with made it into the book.
How long have you been writing your blog online?
2005. I started in December of 2005.
So does it help you writing a blog then to also be writing a book at the same time? Or?
Well, that's a very interesting sort of prongy question, because it's like a rose with thorns, you know? Mm-hmm. Blogging on one hand is a terrific exercise for the writing muscles, for the mind, and it also is a captive test audience that you can sort of float ideas and essays with and see what kind of reaction you get from the readers. On the other hand, it's very easy to get sucked into the vortex of blogging and not do anything else. Mm-hmm. And because it's so much fun to have your own little online magazine where you take all the photos, you edit all the photos, you control the content, you're the writer, the design, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like this seductive thing, but it's, to me, it's a little bit like playing fiddle on the street corner and hoping somebody throws you a nickel every now and then. You know, you can play real good for free. You could be, you know, Itzhak Perlman, and people would probably walk by and maybe fling you a nickel. Mm-hmm. But what you've got, what I found out, the limit that I had to reach was, you know, okay, I'm doing all this blogging and I'm putting all this great stuff out there all the time, but what is it actually contributing to the bottom line?
Right.
People love it.
Because you got to eat, right?
Yeah, you got to eat.
Bad habit.
Exactly. And the other thing is that, you know, I don't know, I guess, you know, people say, oh, she's a blogger, but what does that actually really mean? Can you hold a blog in your hands? No. You know, it's kind of this nebulous thing that's just sort of floating around out there, and that people really, really enjoy and kind of lap up. But to me, a book is real. It's mm-hmm. solid. And as long as they're still publishing books with pages and paper and hardcover, I want to write those. I want to be able to do that. And more and more, it feels like such an honor to have your stuff and your paintings and your writing in a real book.
I see some similarities between Letters from Eden and your blog in that you tell the stories in pictures and there's a sense of letting people experience it mm-hmm. and looking at the picture. And then you have like maybe one or two lines mm-hmm. and then you move on to the next. Now, Letters from Eden isn't really like that, but there's a tonal quality to it.
Right. More conversational.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think blogging helps with that. It helps you sort of like envision this person that you're talking to. And you kind of get an idea of just how much biology background that person might have. And then you sort of pitch things so that almost anybody could start reading anywhere on your blog and not be lost. And I think that's a really good thing, because you find out through your comments section that a lot of people just have almost no background in biology at all. So if you go writing about something really sort of arcane, you've got to do it in a way that makes them feel like they can keep reading and not get bowled over. And so accessibility, I think, is a very important part of good writing, and blogging really helps with that. It helps you realize that not everybody is going to know what a blowfly is or what it does to a bluebird, you know? You got to kind of go back. I want to talk about blowflies, Ann.
I was kind of saving that question.
Can you tell that I'm, like, really head up about blowflies?
Well, I want to talk about blowflies. I want to talk about bluebirds. Let's first talk to Amanda in Columbus, and
okay.
She's got a question for you. Hi, Amanda. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I was calling. We have planted a lot of native plants in our backyard, and this year, for the first time, we've noticed blue-gray gnat catchers really low to the ground, hanging around some of our native grasses that we've planted, and we've always seen them up high in the trees, but this year they're real down low. They're kind of like almost hopping in our mulch and down low in the shrubs.
Okay, okay.
And they seem to be catching something. We were wondering, are they going after mosquitoes?
Quite possibly. Blue-gray gnatcatchers, they have a really wide column that they will forage in. Everywhere from, like, in the early spring, you see them in the very tops of the leafless trees, right? And that's because...
Yep, go ahead.
That's because whatever they're foraging on, there's my dog adding to it. Whatever they're foraging on is high. But as you've noted, they're opportunists, and if there's a hatch of insects coming out of the grasses, they're going to come down for that. The other possibility that may be going on, I mean, you're saying you're seeing them foraging, but early in the spring when the females are nest building, I'm talking about late April, you'll often see them near the ground gathering plant down and other materials for their nests, and the male will be escorting them and singing as he goes. So, that's another possibility. When you see a bird seemingly out of place, it's often a pair that's looking for nesting material.
Does that help, Amanda?
One other question.
Sure.
We have a basketball hoop pole, and the top of the metal pole is missing, mm-hmm. and titmice have built a nest in there, and the babies have been in this pole at least 3 weeks, maybe longer.
21 days.
And 21 days is
okay.
How long they stay.
Okay.
Okay.
And are they... Go ahead.
Well, we were just wondering. It seemed like a long time to stay in the nest.
It is. It is a long time to stay in the nest. There are a couple possibilities here. 21 days is still okay. Titmice leave the nest flying very well and with an almost full-length tail. So don't worry too much. If you suspect there's some problem with their getting out of the basketball pole, and if you see the parents acting distressed, you may want to investigate. But, give them the chance to leave naturally first. You see the parents entering and exiting and taking out fecal sacs and all that good stuff?
You know what? She's off.
Huh. Okay, yeah. So she's taking the answer off air.
Well, I actually accidentally deleted. My finger just twitched and off it went. So
okay.
Sorry about that, Amanda.
Yeah, Amanda, anyway, if 21 days is still in the normal realm, but if it goes a whole lot longer and the birds are having trouble getting out of the nest, you might want to tilt it and see if they need help, because that's not a normal nesting cavity.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Julie Zicafus. You've heard her as an NPR commentator. She's also been on the show many times. She's a natural history writer and artist. If you have a question or comment for her, I'll try not to cut you off. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, back to the bluebirds and the blowflies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I've been really busy with this spring has been, that cold spell that we had where it was just like in the 40s.
You mean like the cold spell from...
Yeah, like our spring.
Yeah.
Right. I wound up having to feed a lot of my bluebirds in the boxes because they were not finding enough food to keep their babies alive. So I went around, I made bug omelet with scrambled eggs and dried flies, and I went around with a tweezers and fed them in the nest.
Put the food in the baby?
Yeah, I took the nest out, whistled like a bluebird.
And the mothers or the parent adults let you do that?
No, they not only let me do it, they dug it. They were like, yeah, good, thanks.
Because there's that myth out there that if you monkey with a baby, they abandon them. I think Bill, when he was on the show the last time, disabused us of that.
Well, their parental bond is very, very strong. And just seeing someone touch their baby is not going to make them abandon it. And bluebirds in particular are quite used to being helped by humans. In fact, I mean, if you think about it, all the bluebirds, I've been doing this box trail for almost 20 years here, they've all been raised in my boxes. they've all had me look in on them at every stage of their lives, from egg to fledging, every week. So it's like, oh, yeah, here comes that lady. She's left us
or whatever
food.
They, yeah.
Oh, look, she's feeding our babies. Awesome. Uh-huh. No, I truly believe that they get it. I do, because as soon as I leave the box, they swoop down, grab the egg food I've left on top of the box, and stuff it in the babies. So, you know, but when the babies were lethargic and cold, I had to hand feed them until they got strong enough to be fed by their parents again. So it was crazy. I was running around in the pouring rain feeding baby birds.
And the reason there wasn't enough food is things just weren't growing.
Well, what happens when it rains and it's really cold like that is the insects just go into dormancy.
Oh, that's right, insects, so right.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. The bluebirds are foraging basically for crickets, grasshoppers, spiders, and caterpillars. So when those things aren't active and they're undercover, they can't find them. And they also get, you know, birds actually get soaked to the skin and can hardly fly sometimes. So it makes it a lot harder for them to feed their young. But anyway, to get back to the blowflies, what I'm doing now that the weather is good, I'm changing nests. I go around with fresh, dry grass that I've gathered early in the spring, and I make a new nest, and I take out the babies and the nest in the bluebird box, and I put the babies in a little bucket for a second, and then I replace the nest, clean out the infested nest, and replace it with fresh, dry grasses, and then put the babies back in. And the blowfly parasite that lives in the nest lining actually sucks the baby's blood and can weaken them and sometimes kill them. So that's something that I do not want going on in my boxes.
You know, back to the blowfly omelet.
Oh, no, that was a bug omelet.
Bug omelet.
The blowfly.
Okay, blowfly. Okay. So bug omelets.
Yeah, the bug omelet.
Can't you just feed them the bugs, or do you just like the idea of giving them an omelet?
Well, no, scrambled eggs, surprisingly enough, is a fabulous food for baby birds. And if you think about it, you know, that their first food is the yolk of their own egg, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the bugs are actually dried domestic flies that I get online from a biological supply company. And I just fold that into the scrambled egg. And then the magic ingredient is also I take the shell of the egg, bake it until it's crispy, and then I grind that up really fine, and I fold that back into the omelet. So it's got three ingredients. It's got egg, finely ground egg shell, and these dried flies. So it's just a really nutritious thing. No, the birds wouldn't pick up a dried insect. They wouldn't know to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, they just don't recognize it as food, really.
Mary in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I live on a street that's lined with very mature trees and some very small trees, short trees. I happened to be walking my dog, and I thought what was a falcon or a hawk in a low tree chasing cardinals, and it scared me, and it was making this awful noise, and cardinals were frightened to death. I mean, I could see them going from one tree to the next or one bush to the next, and this thing was following them, and I just thought that was very unusual. I was afraid for my dog and that it might go after my dog. Mm. But is that unusual, or
okay,
do they feed on other birds?
Oh, yes. And what you're probably witnessing, I have friends in Clintonville who became very fond of a Cooper's hawk that would sit in their backyard. And I actually painted a portrait for them of this bird. The Cooper's hawk is the most common urban hawk now in Ohio. Mm. And it is nesting right, as you notice, in downtown Clintonville. It is a specialist on birds, and cardinals are exactly in the size range that it takes. And it is an excipitor, or a true hawk. There are two hawks that look a lot alike. One's the sharp-shinned, and it's smaller. And the Cooper's is a pretty good-sized hawk. There's absolutely no danger that it's going to go after your dog as prey, because
okay.
it's a very small hawk. It's only about a little over a foot long,
okay.
and it is adapted to taking birds. There are a lot of cardinals, and there aren't many Cooper's hawks. And if you can bring your mind around to enjoying this natural spectacle rather than being horrified by it, you have to realize that they don't eat pancakes, you know?
Well, I'll enjoy it next time. I hope I see it next time. It was pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And it's, you know, just get into it, because this is a natural system, a natural phenomenon that's going on right before your eyes. They're supposed to eat cardinals. It's good. You know,
okay.
we're all feeding them like crazy. We're subsidizing their populations, all these feeder birds that eat seeds. And the Cooper's hawk comes in and says, wow, look at this urban area with nice mature trees I can nest in, and a steady food supply.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I can't wait to Google now and see what it actually looks like. I just really saw the wings and the tail. So thank you very much.
Enjoy it.
And I can't wait to see it.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Mary.
Cool.
We have an email from Barb. She writes, I had a cool experience last week with a bobwhite. I live in Columbus, and I heard a familiar bird, but I had not heard this bird in such a long time, so I figured out it was a bobwhite because of its song. I started calling back to the bird, and before I knew it, this bird was on my back patio. We talked to each other for a good 10 minutes. Then he wandered out of my yard, but I still heard the bobwhite call for a while. Is something like this rare?
Well, bobwhites are practically extirpated from Ohio in the wild. They are a bird that was very popular to be hunted, but they weren't wiped out by overhunting. Bobwhites, it's a small quail with a beautifully patterned face, black and white, and the back is a warm brown. It's got a cute little crest. It's got this fabulous call, just this beautiful little whistle. Anyway, bobwhites were extirpated in Ohio because we are not keeping messy farm fields. Which is what they like, you know. They like edges of fields with hedgerows, with a lot of weed seeds and a lot of insects, and with no-till agriculture where everybody's spraying instead of tilling.
Uh-huh.
We are killing off our bobwhites. So there's the habitat is not there. It's a great increase in ground predators such as raccoons. Now, if you've seen a bobwhite in your backyard in Columbus, it's doubtless come from a release. A lot of game clubs and farms will raise these birds and release these poor pen-raised birds that know nothing of living outdoors, and they wander around. And I've even seen a pen-raised ringneck pheasant running back and forth along a chain-link fence in someone's backyard because it was the only familiar thing in his environment.
Why do they release them?
They release them to shoot them.
Oh.
Yeah, so this little bobwhite, who knows where he came from, but you can bet he's not from a wild population.
What? I don't know. I mean, I guess I have to look up a bobwhite and see what they look like.
Oh,
why would anyone want to kill a bobwhite? Can you eat them?
Oh, yeah, you can eat them, but it's mostly about putting them up, and they go up with a great thunder of wings, and then they're really fun to try to hit, I guess.
Oh.
Not my cup of tea, but a lot of people get into these fast-flying game birds like woodcock. I mean, I would imagine that woodcock tastes like earthworms, which is what they eat. But the people like to shoot them because they go up really fast into the air. Ringneck pheasant, now they happen to be delicious. I was raised on cream pheasant in South Dakota. But, you know, again, it's the thrill of trying to hit this bird that goes right up under your feet.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I grew up with bobwhite quail in Virginia, and it's just my favorite thing to hear. About one of the only places I've heard them wild in Ohio is reclaimed strip mine near Gallipoli.
Mm-hmm.
Called Crown City Strip Mine.
A big prairie.
Yeah, it's basically a big old grassland now. A lot of exotic grasses, but some native grasses too. And you know, finally giving them the kind of habit that they need to survive. But it's very, very rare in Ohio now.
I'm excited in Worthington in the big park along the river. They're putting in meadows.
Oh, wonderful.
And one thing about this season, there's just so many more flowers and wildflowers.
Yeah. And butterflies, I'll bet.
Yes.
Yes.
And then there's going to be birds when everything seeds.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, Ann, you got to get into butterflies. It's so fun. It's really, really cool
well,
to identify them.
Did Bill just do a book on butterflies?
He did, Butterflies and Hummingbirds.
That's
yeah,
right.
Houghton Mifflin. Yep. Yeah, it's a wonderful book. Lots of information on attracting both of them to your backyard and, you know, feeding hummingbirds and planting flowers for hummingbirds and butterflies. A lot of the pictures were taken right on our farm, too.
It's called Butterflies and Hummingbirds?
Yeah, I think it is.
We'll double check
on that. Make sure I got
the
title right.
Yeah, Bill Thompson's the author. He is married to Julie Zickafoos. What a family.
We have fun.
That's who I'm talking to, Julie Zickafoos, natural history writer, artist, NPR commentator. If you have a question or comment for her, you can email us. I'll get to some emails coming up. You can also call us at 614-292-8513, and that email address is allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
A group of friends are making an amateur film. They capture images of a mysterious train crash. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Super 8 director J.J. Abrams, who says the inspiration for that thriller came from his own childhood obsession with filmmaking. Abrams co-created the hit TV shows Felicity, Alias, and Lost. Join us.
Fresh air in just about 15 minutes here, well, 20 minutes, on 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. As far as the weather goes for Central Ohio, very nice for the next couple of days. We'll have a high in the mid-70s today, mostly clear tonight with a low in the middle 50s. Then on Tuesday, partly cloudy, tomorrow's high again in the middle 70s. Tuesday night, low in the mid-50s. By Wednesday, partly cloudy and a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. A high in the upper 70s, getting a little bit warmer as time goes on. 20% chance of rain on Wednesday. And by Thursday, 50% chance of rain and a high in the lower 80s. So, right now we have 71 degrees at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus. There are many ways to get the latest local news. You can follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Or you can get your headlines delivered by email each day by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just go to wosu.org/email and you too will be in the loop.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Julie Zicafus, the natural history writer, artist, and NPR commentator. You can give us an email at allsides@wosu.org if you want to have a question or comment for her. You can also call us at 614-292-8513. I've got this email from Paul. He writes, "For those who get to Florida, there's better things to do than eat, shop, and hang out at the condos. This winter, I spent dozens of hours in the Everglades and at Naples Eagle Lakes Park, and the abundance of birds and other wildlife is amazing. Corkscrew Swamp, Big Cypress, and other areas yield photo and watching opportunities for various heron species, egrets, cormorants, ospreys, red-shouldered hawks and storks, as well as gators and snakes. If you get to South Florida, make a day trip to Clyde Butcher's studio in Big Cypress. His photos are amazing, and the gallery grounds are great for photographing birds."
Florida is such a trip. I took the kids there this past January, to the Space Coast Birding Festival in Titusville. And, man, it was just to go from Ohio in January to Florida, where there's just all these birds walking around in front of you. And it was such a treat. And I thought, wow, I never really got Florida before that trip. And then it all made perfect sense to me because I think I was just at the point where I was so sick of this Ohio winter.
Yeah.
And just to get down there where there's just all these amazing water birds and, like you said, gators and snakes and bugs. Maybe it's not for everybody, but Florida has so much more than people give it credit for. It's really great.
A lot of it's been wiped out.
A lot of it's been wiped out, but you know what's really heartening is a lot of it has been saved.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who blogs at Pure Florida. He's at pureflorida.blogspot.com, and he's a high school biology teacher. So you can just imagine the stuff, the knowledge that he brings to this. His blog is sort of a lot like mine. It's a lot of stuff around his home in Florida, but it's also, you know, just field trips he takes with his school kids and fishing, and it's amazing how much natural history you can get into in Florida.
Before we move on too far, I want to just tell people that the book we were talking about was Hummingbirds and Butterflies.
Yes, and I've got it in front of me. It was by Bill Thompson III and Connie Toops, who's
right.
A dear friend of ours, who actually gave me 5 golden raspberry plants. And that's kind of like giving somebody a pony.
Wow.
It's like, oh, look, raspberries. I've always wanted raspberries. Wait, do I have to dig a bed for it? Which I did. And I spent all day Saturday digging a bed for these raspberry plants. And I actually got sun poisoning. I had to be
really?
Put down at the end of the day. It wasn't good.
Like giving someone a pony.
Yeah.
That is that.
She's been threatening to do it for a while. And she gave me one little plant last year, which conveniently died because I planted it in a kind of a crummy place. I didn't know it at the time. I tried to take care of it, but it died. This year, she came back at me with 5 absolutely beautiful strapping plants. So what was I going to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Dig them a bed.
Yeah, do the right thing.
Do the right thing, yeah.
Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann, Julie.
Hi.
Ann, I had a quick question for you. You were talking about the park in Worthington. I was wondering if you were talking about off West Wilson Bridge or whether you were talking about High Banks.
I'm talking about the Olentangy bike trail park.
Okay, like off Antrim. No.
But north of Antrim.
North of
Antrim. 161, yes.
Okay, so that, that would be sort of like parking might be off of West Wilson Bridge?
It goes right along the river.
Okay.
So you can get to it at the high school where, you know, the high school grounds go up against the river by 161, and there's a trail that goes all the way up to
right,
up to Hills.
I know there's a trail. I was just trying to figure out where you'd put your car.
Oh, park at the high school.
Oh, okay.
That's I'd say the easiest thing, down by the flats, down by the high school.
Okay, great. So. Okay, now a couple comments.
Okay.
Yesterday I saw my first fleeting glimpse of a monarch, which is always encouraging, but even, I mean, really special to me for whatever reason, my first baby mantis.
Oh.
Yeah. About an inch
Aren't
long.
Aren't they cute?
A little mantid just creeping along the side of the house. And, of course, we don't, you know, you and I would maybe date similarly to an age when there were, like, butterflies in your yard and stuff like that, which, yeah, you can still get some, but... When I was a kid, you know, you'd just walk into a vacant field and it was lousy with them.
And, should be now, too. I mean, a lot of people are gardening for them. And,
and people still keep putting that stuff on their lawns. And, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, anyway, I just wanted to offer some encouragement because, you know, when I see the first mantid of the year, that excites me.
They are exciting. I love mantids. I've actually made the mistake of bringing a couple of mantids, Chinese mantids, which are the huge ones, inside for the winter because I couldn't stand to see them die.
Yeah.
I fed them well into February and March, feeding them mealworms and things like that.
Yeah.
And what actually happens to them is they slowly deliquesce, which is one of my favorite little used words. They just kind of fall apart because they aren't meant to live that long.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know if you've seen the movie with Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn called Death Becomes Her.
Yes.
I have
it
not.
It was just on TV. I didn't watch it.
I have not, but now
that's a really interesting comparison.
You must. Because basically, you know, it's like one day a leg will just snap off. And then,
okay.
It's horrible.
Thank you. Okay, well, I won't bring them inside.
Don't get attached.
Julie's in a mood today, Paul.
I can tell.
I'm on a roll.
You know, the raspberry's like a pony. Yeah. I knew somehow one of the wheels had come off the rail at that point.
She's deliquescing.
I am. My brain is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Yep.
6-1. Fadia from Columbus. Is that how I pronounce your name?
Yes, it is.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, I wanted to comment on the Bob Waits for Julian and you, Anne. I grew up on a farm north of Columbus. And we had Bob Whites, and there would be a covey of quail that would come up, and one would get on top of a post, and he'd just sing his little heart out outside the window in the yard. And
beautiful.
Absolutely loved that. And then the blizzard, I think it was in 78, and it was like the grass, the snow was on the ground for so long, and it was so deep. We did not see any after that.
Yeah. I should have mentioned that.
And snakes the same way. Very few snakes.
Huh.
And we have tried. My dad has gotten baby quail, which are so cute. They're like little gumballs that just pop all over the place when they're startled. And what you try and do is have as little human interaction with them as possible. And so Dad would put a cover on the back and on the sides, and so would feed them without them seeing human beings.
Interesting.
And then try and release them into the field, and they just never were able to make it, even doing what you could to not get them used to human beings. And
sure.
You'd even go down and startle them intentionally so they would be afraid of people and react.
You know, that's the thing about raising these game birds is that we discount the importance of the culture that their mother passes along to them. And they can't learn from each other, really. They have to learn from a bird that knows the ropes of survival. So they have, as you say, they have to learn the vigilance behavior. They have to be taught what to eat and, you know, what's good just by following her example. So it's really hard on these little game bird chicks to be released without having a mom, you know, to guide them through. It's kind of like letting a bunch of 10-year-olds loose at the, you know, downtown
around Columbus and saying, okay, forage, you know, there's a restaurant somewhere here, you know. It's really tough on them. So, yeah, there's an awful lot of learning that they do by imitating their mother.
It's interesting what Fadia brought up about the blizzard and the long-term ramifications of that. I really didn't think about the blizzard causing so many problems for snakes and...
I'm not at all sure about snakes because they generally have hibernacula that are protected underground. The bobwhites, though, and bluebirds as well, it's very, very clear that their populations will crash during these profound ice and snow events where there's maybe 4 feet of snow on top of their food supply. What are they going to do? They can't dig.
Because they winter here?
The bobwhites, sure, yeah, they don't migrate. So yeah, it can be colossal, the impacts of one good blizzard. And on bluebirds, too, the ice storms that cover up all their food in a half inch of ice for 3 or 4 days.
Right.
How are they supposed to survive that? You know, so that it's part of a natural cycle. But, you know, with the bobwhites, it's really been a three-point whammy of losing habitat through changes in farming practices and immense development. And just not having the kind of grasslands they need, and then the weather, and then the explosion in ground predators like raccoons. That these birds nest right on the ground. They're laying these delicious little eggs right on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough world for bobwhites right now.
Gareth and Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann and Julie.
Hello.
We have an organic farm up in near Marion, Ohio. And about 7 or 8 years ago, we had to go into a 3-year program where we could put no crops in the ground, or at least not let it lay fallow.
Sure.
And just let it grow up. And it the brush grew up pretty good in the field. And there was this raptor or hawk of some sort, pretty large, that would just kind of float and flutter in the breeze. About 4 or 5 feet off the ground. Mm-hmm. What was that?
Was this during the summer or the...
Yeah, the summer.
Okay. It's possible that you had a marsh harrier, or a harrier, northern harrier is the proper name. It's also called a marsh hawk is the old name for it.
Okay.
Did you ever notice a white band across the top of its rump?
Yes.
There you go. That was a marsh hawk, yeah, or harrier.
It's a big bird.
It is a big bird with quite a long wingspan. And what they're doing is listening for voles rustling in the grass. They're specialists on very small mammals like voles. And they'll listen, hover, and then pounce down with those long legs and grab them.
It's amazing to watch.
That's a very nice thing to see in the summer, too. I mean, we'd have spotty nesting by northern harrier in Ohio, but only in very extensive grasslands, like you mentioned.
Yeah, we're up by the Marcelles Lake area and wildlife area up here at Big Island.
Okay.
And so there is water up here, and so that could be. I did have a comment also about the bobwhite. You're hearing comments now.
That's okay.
The winter of 77 and 78 were extremely hard. I never saw one after those.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
Yes. Yeah, so that could be. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for farming the earth the way it's meant to be farmed.
Well, it's a little tough getting started, and we are watched pretty closely by the organic organization in order that we do everything right.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so far we are.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Pat and Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How's everybody?
Very well.
Good. You were speaking earlier about the bobwhite, and you talked about how they're down around Gallipolis in the reclaimed strip areas.
Yes.
And it came to mind the wilds. I was wondering if you know whether they have got involved in reintroducing the bobwhite, because it sounds to me like the habitat you're speaking of is, you know, right there.
That's a very good question. I don't know the actual answer to whether anyone's tried to reintroduce them there, but I do know that they aren't there.
Oh, they are not there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I get there quite a bit, and I would know if they were there. I don't know if anyone's tried to reintroduce them. The wilds have some challenges because the subsoil is very poor.
Right.
And they are having, you know, some questions surrounding productivity of some of these grassland birds that do nest there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'd never really thought of it this way, but when you have depauperate soil, you don't have as many insects and you don't have as good a weed seed crop. And it just kind of has repercussions all the way up. So they're really actively and aggressively trying to restore that ecosystem, including improving and amending the soil there. Because, you know, the wilds doesn't have trees because the trees can't grow on that subsoil.
Right.
And that's kind of a sobering thing. You can talk about strip mine reclamation, but if you've taken the nutrients out of the soil, that's how do you reclaim that?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a lot better than I grew up in Jefferson County, and we were left with a lot of the high walls, you know, the where they would just strip and nothing was done for reclamation.
Yeah, not even any contouring. Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Pat. We're almost out of time. My guest is Julie Zicafus, NPR commentator, natural history writer, artist. She's got a book coming out. When's that book coming out, Julie?
It's coming out in spring of 2012, and it's called The Bluebird Effect, My Life-Changing Encounters with Wild Birds.
Oh, you have a title for it now.
I do. I finally got a title.
Cool.
Marketing approved it, which was like a huge... I couldn't tell anybody what it was called until I knew that the title was going to fly. So
okay, so now we have a title. Every show, we get a little bit more.
A little tiny little glimmers of information, yes. But it's in production now. It's pretty exciting. I'm just getting the very last painting scanned for it, the ones that were too big to send off. And I'm going to be sending that disc to Houghton Mifflin Harcourt this week. And I'm just, the excitement is building.
Barb sent a picture of her Bob White.
Oh.
So we've got it. We've got some kind of JPEG or something. We'll post that.
Cute.
If we can, we'll get that on Facebook.
Oh.
So you can check it out. I only see it like a, you know, a copy from the printer kind of thing. But it looks really cute.
Very cute. Yeah. You got to Google Bob White. You got to see that bird somehow.
Yeah, I will definitely check it out. Julie Zicafus, we're basically out of time. I only have a couple minutes left, so I want to thank you, and I hope you'll join us again real soon.
Oh, thank you, Anne. I always really, really enjoy talking with you. And I'm sorry, I was kind of endorphinized this morning. I was a little bit excited.
No. Don't ever apologize. I hope you have a great summer down there.
Thank you. You too, Ann Fisher.
And everybody, thanks for listening. I want to say thanks to the All Sides crew while I'm thinking about it. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. The All Sides staff includes producer Linda Taylor. My associate producer today is Charlie Pickard. He is subbing for Amy Jurevich right now in our radio intern Leticia Wiggins is working hard, and also radio operations director Kevin Petrola, senior broadcast technician Eric French. Thanks to everybody for all your help. Thanks again to Julie Zicafus, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.